I didn't know that you'd shot it twice.
Yeah. I did it. So before the racing season, when it was the last weekend.
In February?
Yeah, or first weekend of February.
Yep.
I shot it. I shot it once in flights. Did okay. Won a little bit of money. Wasn't terrible.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, right on.
I was in, I lucked into like, I mean, that's the best thing about shooting flights. You don't have to shoot great
sure.
to be able to win a couple bucks.
Yeah.
And then the next year, I got convinced by a couple people to go shoot the champion line.
You did?
Yeah. You paid. Why?
You paid the full $650 and went in for it?
I did.
Probably a good experience.
It was kind of like, you want to go shoot in the arena floor. Sure. Like, I was like, I know him. There's a 0% chance. I think I dropped a 9, like the second end. So I was like, I'm out. And the guys I was shooting with were like, are you serious? And I'm like, yeah, I'm here for fun.
Like, are you serious?
Don't worry. I'm going to be in the basement on Sunday. I'm just here for fun. I want to get the full experience.
Yeah.
Because I knew the next year, the Vegas shoot, it wasn't going to be that weekend anymore.
Yep.
So now it's during the racing season, so I can't go. So I'm like, I might as well enjoy it.
Right.
The last time I can.
Well, you have to, maybe you'll have to ask for that weekend off in the future.
No. The racing stuff pays
this
way
Super Bowl
too much.
Of archery. You got it. You got it.
Yeah. Maybe when I get to the point where I can shoot my bow and I know I'm going to be able to shoot a 900, but then by that time I'll be done racing.
To try to guarantee a win, be like, okay, it's worth it because I'm going to win.
I heard they had, I don't know how true, I haven't looked, but I heard they had like 36 flights for freestyle.
Wow. Yeah, I think when I was there, I was in like 14 or 15.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I didn't shoot great on the first, which was kind of, I had the Vegas nerves the first day. Like I was great in the practice range, great first two ends of practice, and that whistle blew for score, and it was just completely fell apart.
God, I know. Stupid, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was telling Brady I was more nervous, I think, on every arrow for all 90 arrows than I was on any elk I've
it's
ever
like the first
I've
two ends shot. And then it's the last end.
Yeah,
because the first
I'm
two ends
up.
You just want to get going. And then on the last end you just want to finish strong because you good mojo for the next day.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want your last arrow at Vegas to be an 8.
Mine was a 9.
Okay.
But considering how I'd been doing, I would take it at that point.
Yeah.
I was like, oh shit, a 9. Thank God.
It's in the yellow.
Well, thanks for coming. We appreciate you hanging out in town.
Yeah.
We have a special guest. Jeff, is it Cordero?
Cordero.
I got it right. Jeff Cordero. I think we met you at TAC. I think prior to that, you and I have exchanged a bunch of messages via Instagram. You had you drew a late season archery elk tag last year in a state. We can't say states anymore, right, Brady?
No, you gotta stop saying anything.
But you drew a tag, and I think we ended up swapping a bunch of information about that. I got a frog in my throat. Sorry, it always happens about this stage in the game. But you're an interesting guy. We talked at TAC a lot, and I think you were in the booth for probably an hour, and I think 45 minutes of it at least was just me peppering you with questions because you have an interesting job. So thanks for hanging out, and I'm sure you're going to endure a bunch of questions from us today about your living because it's actually pretty interesting.
Yeah, we were talking, I think, earlier that we want to talk about your stuff, and you probably want to talk more hunting, and we don't really want to talk about hunting now.
That's fine because the hunting stuff is the stuff I'm not as good at, so we can talk the other stuff for sure.
Yeah. So we'll get into that. I'm going to hit promo first. We're only 4 minutes in.
That's a world record on the promo time.
Yep, so I'm going to hit promo. If you guys are listening to the podcast, I guess one, right off the top, I would love it if you guys would like and share the podcast. So we're trying to grow the audience a little bit. If you like the podcast, if you've been a listener for a while, reach out and share it with somebody. That would mean a lot to me personally. And then plus, we just want to grow the audience. So share it, right?
Share it.
Also, leave us a review, which I heard is a thing. I'm just finding that out
I was reading some the other day.
So leave a review. We'd appreciate that. But if you guys want to sign up for a Go Hunt Insider account, you can use the promo code podcast. If you do that, we're going to give you $50, $50 back in the Go Hunt gear shop that you can use towards the purchase of any gear that you want in the shop. We're going to probably talk some archery. I know that you just recently bought an archery shop, which is a fun little thing. It's an endeavor.
Yeah.
A labor of love. Yeah, we're starting to get more archery stuff in the shop, but you guys can use that $50 back towards the shop. Still a great time to do some research, try to draw some tags. By the time this goes out, you guys will have probably missed the New Mexico application deadline, but hopefully you got your app in, you made your selections, and Lady Luck shines on you, and you draw an elk tag or something, right, Rudy?
Deer tag.
A deer tag? Yeah, an elk tag, like I said.
It's the one I apply for now.
Use the promo code podcast. And then with that, we'll jump in. Did I miss anything else? Sig, shout out Sig.
Shout out Sig Sauer.
Sig Sauer. You ever try those?
Not yet.
Have you played with them at all?
I haven't. I've heard great things
about
them.
They're pretty incredible.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, for your crowd, like the NASCAR crowd, they would be incredible.
Oh, yeah, like stabilized binos?
Stabilized bino on the stands NASCAR, would be amazing.
I think our spotters, so some of the big tracks we go to, like 2.5 mile tracks, like on the back stretch, they're so far away, and they're trying to clear cars by like a couple inches. So they're all using binos, but they're just using, I mean, none of them, I think, are using anything great.
Okay, so we're going to put you guys in touch with
that would be a game changer. No kidding. Like a pair of 16 Zulu 6s. Image stabilizing are incredible.
16s might be a little tight.
I mean, they're pretty
nice though.
Pretty impressive. Yeah. The last day of Vegas, Neville shot. So I was sitting by Neville's wife and we were sitting there watching. She had a pair of Neville's old Vortexes and I was like, here, try these SIGs. Cause she's, you know, looking for 10s, right? When he's shooting.
Yeah.
And she was just like, oh, this is so cool. She's like, this is incredible because it really does just flatten out your view.
Yeah, especially when you plop that stabilized mode on there. It's like,
we'll have to get you a pair. You can take those to the race and really blow people's minds.
I'm sure our spotter would appreciate that.
Is that his dedicated job?
He's yeah, just that's all he does is he
You
spots.
Literally have a spotter job there?
Yeah.
Not Jeff. Well, Jeff's
not me.
I know, yeah, yeah. But every team has a spotter.
Yeah, so it's mandated by NASCAR. It's more of it's a safety thing, but it can be a huge advantage if you have a good spotter.
Is he mic'd up? He's talking to the driver?
Yes. Yeah, so there's a couple different kinds of communication we use. There's an open radio channel, which is like you guys, if you came to the racetrack, you can get the frequency and you can listen to everything that we hear. And it's the communication between the driver, the crew chief, and the spotter. Those are the only three that really talk on that channel, but it's open. Anyone can listen to it.
Really?
Yeah.
I would think that would be like competitive advantage to like...
We have other channels that are private channels, like just inter-team communication that nobody else has access to. But it's an open channel. So like we can scan everybody else's radios to hear what they're doing, to hear when they're going to pit. But we use a lot of code words and, you know, trying to be...
There's a lot of gamesmanship in the game then.
There is. But yeah, that open mic channel, like, I mean, you can listen to it just as a fan. You can rent the scanners at the racetrack and listen to it. So everything that I'm hearing in the pit, like you guys can hear the same thing, him clearing the driver, telling him, you know, where other people on the racetrack, kind of going over all that.
I wonder what kind of optics they use. I'm all curious about that.
Yeah, I'll have to find out. Yeah. Before we get too deep, let's establish like who you are and what you do.
Yeah.
So give us some background on where you're from, how you got involved in this fascinating job that you do.
Yeah, originally I'm from Connecticut. Grew up there, had a friend that had a race car in high school, started helping him out, and then just kind of, I've been going to the racetrack for as long as I can remember. My dad would take me to the racetrack Saturday nights, local short track in Connecticut, and just loved race cars, watched NASCAR as a kid, and then kind of got to the point of life where I was going to college, still working on race cars, not going to school, probably doing too much of the partying, and not paying enough attention to school. Had to make a decision in life where I was either going to taper back on racing and focus on school and kind of like dial that in, or I was going to quit school and go racing. And as a 21-year-old, going to school wasn't exactly a large
what
priority
were you
of
studying?
Mine. I had nothing. Just taking classes. Yeah.
Did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
No.
No.
Nah, originally I went in because I was going to get a business degree because I went to a tech high school. Okay. So I studied plumbing and heating when I was there. And I was for sure that's what I was going to do. I was going to be a plumber when I got out of school. And then I was going to go to college to get a business degree so that way I could like manage my business. But quickly getting into school, it just wasn't, I don't know. I'm not bad at school when I apply myself, but I just didn't want to apply myself because I was just too busy going to the racetrack, working on race cars.
Did you want to be a driver?
At one point I did, but I didn't have the money to like buy a race car and do all that.
Yeah.
So the next best thing was just working on them and then kind of just, I've loved racing forever. So kind of reached that point where, you know, seeing these guys on TV in the NASCAR Cup Series, like they're doing it. And I'm like, nothing really separates me from them except for experience and the fact that I live in Connecticut. So packed up everything I had. My parents moved down to North Carolina.
At 21?
At 21, gotcha. 2009.
Was your dad fully supportive of this? Was he just like...
Funny because I didn't know this until after, like a couple of years ago probably. But when they were driving me down, I guess my mom asked my dad like, hey, do you think he's going to be able to make a living doing this?
Uh-huh.
Or is this something that, you know...
You want to do.
Yeah. But I mean, she was just concerned like, if this is an avenue that we're going to go, he's going to go down. Like, can he actually make a living doing it? And my dad kind of was like, yeah, I mean, they make okay money and, you know, enough, I'm sure, to survive. And obviously you have to make it. It's a competitive sport. So
sure,
you have to earn your way onto a team and keep it. 16 years later, still doing it. Love it. Yeah. It's a huge passion of mine. So it's.
Did your dad was a fan? What did your dad do for a living?
He worked at a pharmaceutical company.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Just as he worked in the shipping department receiving.
Gotcha. He was a NASCAR fan. He was a car racing fan.
Yeah. I mean, he would drag my mom to the racetrack, you know,
really?
And they were, yeah. Just cause like in Connecticut, we had these three short tracks that were from where I lived. The Waterford Speed Bowl was 10 minutes away. Stafford Springs was like 45-50 and Thompson was about an hour, and they raced Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. So you could go three nights in a row, and there was only an hour drive to watch, you know, your average Joe putting a race car together, scrapping it together to get to the racetrack just to race because it's a passion thing. Like the short track racing across America, if you want to see really good racing and see people that are passionate about it, go to your local short track. Like the NASCAR stuff's really cool. It's on TV. You can see it. You can follow your favorite driver. But if you want to see the people that absolutely love this, that are not making money to do it, they're doing it because it's a passion of theirs. Yeah. Saturday night short track racing, whether it's dirt track, asphalt track.
Yeah, yeah.
You ever watched like dirt track or short
yeah,
track?
Yeah, so I have a college roommate. He was from Farmington, New Mexico, which is not a very big, you know, it's a small area, relatively speaking, right? And one weekend, he invited me to come out to Farmington, and we went, and I was like, what are we going to do? And the one night, he was like, yeah, let's go to the short track, and it's dirt track. And I was like, I don't know, man. And my parents are from Indiana, right? Like, I've been to the 500. Like, I wouldn't say we're fans, but like I'm kind of a novice car racing fan, a little bit indie, right? I always watch the 500 in May. Anyway, so we go to this dirt track and I was completely enamored. Like it was so cool. I mean, just the community vibe, so many people just hanging out, tons of food trucks, people just like everyday people just there watching dirt track racing and just like some really good racing, like really getting after it. It was super exciting. Like I remember watching that and thinking, oh yeah, I totally get this. This is awesome. I could see going to it, you know. So you had three tracks within an hour then.
Yeah, in Connecticut. And I'm very fortunate to be there. Really good racing community in that area. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, I had a friend in high school, had a car, and it literally was just, hey, why don't you just come hang out?
Right.
And I knew nothing about race cars getting into that. I mean, I could very light. I could rotate tires and change the oil on like a regular car. But like when it came to race cars, I knew nothing. And I just started hanging out, and you learn a little bit. You learn a little bit. They give you a little bit more responsibility. You're not just wiping down the car anymore. You're actually like helping out.
Yeah.
And it was just something I was like, I don't care what I do. This is what I want to do. Racing is something I want to be a part of. It's some level and some, like, even if I was still plumbing back at home, like I would still be going to the short track. Hell, I might've had a little like 4-cylinder beater car to go race, but yeah,
it's gotcha. Just,
love it.
So when you went to North Carolina?
Moved to North Carolina because that's where all the NASCAR teams are.
Did you have a plan there? Did you have an in? Or were you just like, I'm going to go to North Carolina and just see what happens?
Pretty much.
Really?
I knew a couple people. Like I knew from race, eventually moved my way up to like a local Northeast touring division. Used to be the Busch North Series at the time. It's been absolved and it's been absorbed by some other racing series. But that was kind of like the eye-opening experience. Like, hey, I could really do this. Like, there's a couple guys on that team that got paid to do that, and that's all they did. And I'm like, I could do this. Like, I really want to do this. So everyone's always said, like, and well, and those guys on that team, like, if you want to do this, you have to go to North Carolina because that's where the job's at. And I went down there. I knew maybe three or four people, like, tight that I could kind of call, but none of them got me a job. But then it was like, what do you want to do in racing? There's a lot of different ways you can go. If you have an engineering degree, you kind of go into the engineering side of it. If you're just a mechanic, you kind of go into the shop, or you can go work on a car like on the weekends, the road cruise life. But what really I was interested in was the pit crew stuff. I wanted to be a pit crew guy. I wanted to.
What's a pit crew?
No, pit crew.
Oh, pit crew. I thought you said a picker. I was like, what's a picker?
No, I wanted to be on the pit crew.
Okay.
So I wanted to change tires. I wanted to go over the wall. I wanted to like, I just watched it on TV, and that was some of the most exciting stuff that I saw during the races was those guys in the pits changing the tires. There's actually a school in North Carolina where you can go to do that. And it is a very, it's like a rudimentary school where they kind of teach you how to do the basics. They kind of give you like the, learn the ropes kind of thing. It's like an 8-week crash course. And then after that, you can pay to be a part of, like, it's like a gym membership. You can use the facility, you can practice, you can kind of hone your skills. Wow. Yeah. So like I did that for a year.
You did the, you went to the, you did the
I
school.
It's like called the pit school. I went to the pit school. I did that for about a year until I got an opportunity to go try out at one of the big, you know, racing teams. And then
so it's actually tryouts.
Oh yeah. It's yeah. It's competitive.
What's a tryout look like for a pit crew? You change a tire, but yeah. Like.
It's changed a lot since I've been in the sport. But back then in 2010, the team I was going with needed a tire changer because someone else they had got let go or they let them go. So they needed somebody just to fill in for a couple races. Mm-hmm. And they said, hey, come to practice. We'll check you out. And if it works, we have these four races you can do. We're not going to pay you anything, but we'll cover your expenses to go to the racetrack. And you're in a minivan with six other dudes driving to like Michigan from North Carolina. So it's like, yeah, but it was an opportunity. It was an in. So I showed up, did the pit practice, just like a normal, you come in for pit practice, do a couple pit stops. They kind of evaluate you and you're like, all right, you're competent. You kind of know what you're doing. Let's see where it goes. You want to do these four races? Yeah, let's do them.
But what are they really evaluating you on? Like, is it just time and like efficiency?
At that level I was at, it was like very basic. They just wanted to make sure you can like get the lug nuts off, get the wheel tight. You
can do something, yeah.
Yeah, you don't look like your hair's on fire the whole time. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. So, and the ARCA series it was for, like pit stops are not like super important. Like they're there, but they're not like, it's not like you're going to win or lose a race on pit road particularly because there's like five cars in the ARCA series that can win any week. So doing that, made it, got that, and then eventually towards the end of that year, because it was at the end of the year 2010, someone else got fired and then they needed someone to work full time. So that was my end to get in full time, and that's where it started.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
What's the Mikel, I have so many questions. What's the process of change? Like, how long have you been doing it, I guess, now at this point?
This is my 16th season in 16th NASCAR.
16th year in NASCAR.
Yep. This is my probably 11th year in the Cup Series. Okay. Then the Cup Series is the top level.
Yeah.
I changed front tires on the 24 car for William Byron, Hendrick Motorsports.
When you say front tires, you change both front tires or did you just change one?
Both front tires.
So pit stop, car comes in, you're changing both.
Yep.
Why not? Why wouldn't it be faster to have a guy for each tire?
We're limited on how many guys go over the wall.
Okay. Mm.
Yep. So we're only allowed five guys to go over the wall. There's a front tire changer, a rear tire changer, a jack man, a tire carrier, and the fuel man. And that's changed a lot since when I got into this 16 years ago, there were seven guys that went over the wall.
Okay.
And then NASCAR has slowly taken a guy away like each time.
Thing for too many people over the wall, kind of?
They say it was a safety thing, like less people over the wall. Less people to get hurt. Just
percentages.
Percentages. Yeah. Some of it too, I think, was maybe parity, trying to like, cause there was teams that were really good and they kind of dominated pit road. Mm. So they're like, okay, if we can change something, it's going to bring a little more parity
or something to it then.
So, and again, like when I started, it was the wheel had five lug nuts on it. Now we're down to one big center locking lug nut, like every other big racing series, like F1 and IndyCar.
So you got one lug for each tire.
Yeah. So car comes in for a pit stop. We come in, all of us jump over the wall. When the car is one pit stall behind us.
How do you know when to go over the wall?
Well, that's what...
Okay, you're getting there. I'm jumping ahead. My bad.
No, you're good. All of our the pit stalls on pit road, we're allowed to jump off the wall and touch the ground when the car is one stall away from being in your stall. So it gives you time to get out there so you don't get smoked while you're running out there, which happens. But we jump out there. The car comes and pulls as a front tire changer. I'm waiting for the right front. The driver pulls it right in front of me, stops. I drop down. Take the lug nut off, pull the right front tire off, throw it back to the wall. The jack man jacks the race car. He takes the new right front tire and puts it on. I tighten it up. We run around. All the same stuff's going on in the back of the car. Mm-hmm. We run around to the left side, jack it up. I pull the left front tire off. Our tire carrier puts the left front tire on, and then we drop it.
So you're taking a tire off, and you're the lug nut guy then?
I'm the lug nut guy. Okay. Yeah, I'm got the wheel gun. Yeah.
But you're also grabbing it and chucking it, right?
Grabbing it and chucking it. 55-pound tire, just pulling it out of there. We're doing four tires and gas in like 8.5-9 seconds. We're done on the right side with the right front tire in 3 seconds or less.
I changed a tire weeks ago. It took me about 35, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
On the way home.
Yeah. But then is there like, you have to think about where you're putting this tire, obviously, so you don't want it to bounce and roll away, or someone else grabbing this tire, or are you actually chucking it and it's like somehow staying where it's at? And like,
there's a sign, there's a method. I mean, it depends on where you're at on pit road. So there's 40 pit stalls on pit road. Typically there's usually 36 cars in a race. There's usually 43 stalls, but it's somewhere in the 40 to 43 stalls. There's a couple pit stalls that are advantageous, that are competitive advantages, because they're not all the stalls are not nose to tail. Sometimes there's opening in the walls for the cars to like come out of the garage area and go out. So those are openings. And then pit stall one, there's nobody in front of you. So you can send that tire as long as it gets back to the wall. Yeah. Like, you don't have to keep it really tight and really close. All those openings, same kind of thing. You get a little bit more, I can be a little bit more loosey goosey with it. I can just pull it off and chuck it. But if we have someone pitted right in front of us, kind of what you're saying, you have to be a little bit more like
precise
at throwing that tire.
You can't hit their car or another guy.
Can't put it in their pit stall because then it's interfering. And then you might come down pit road third, and then you roll it into their pit stall, and you'll go to the tail end of the longest line because it's a penalty. So you go from third to 28th. You know, that could be detrimental for your day.
I don't want to trail out there because you'll probably be doing that.
And your driver's pissed.
Yeah, everyone's pissed. Crew chief, driver.
At you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
Gotcha.
Try not to do that.
You said pit practice. How often do you practice?
3 days a week. We practice Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Really?
Yeah.
For how long?
Pit practice probably lasts about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour.
And how many tires will you change at pit practice? We'll do
anywhere from 4 to 8 pit stops, like actually simulated in the race. Like, so it's, we have
full,
a car,
full simulation.
Full
car,
deal.
Car will go out.
The car whole drives around in a circle, comes in. We got a kid. We got two kids that work in the pit department. That's all they do is they drive the pit stop cars.
Really?
Oh,
that's
yeah,
a full-time job?
That's their job. I mean, they make sure the cars are ready each week for practice.
Sounds like a fun job.
Yeah.
Every track we go to has different setups. And then different setups means different things for us pitting the race car. It can sometimes make it harder, sometimes make it easier. And then we'll, they make that as close to the race as possible. So it's a good simulation for us that week going into it.
How competitive is it among pit crews?
It's extremely competitive. The difference between winning and losing a race or being first and 15th on pit road could be a tenth of a second, 2/10 of a second.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy moly. Do they have like, pit crew competitions?
We do one every year. NASCAR puts it on. So there's two things that as a pit crew guy you can win. They have the NASCAR competition, which is right circled around the All-Star race, which is like mid-May.
Okay.
It's one pit stop. Driver comes in. You're the only ones on pit road. Everyone's watching. TV cameras are there. The whole thing, you do one pit stop, you burn the car out, he leaves, he runs a lap, and then the fastest pit crew gets the prize money at the end of it, the trophy, the awards, the accolades, everything.
You ever won?
Not that one.
Dang.
I know. But then that's a very, like, everyone wants to win that. But the one that I think a lot of pit crew guys really cherish is the Mechanics Wear Most Valuable Pit Crew Award, which they give out to the best pit crew of the playoffs for that year. I've won that twice, finished second in it twice. So I've been on some pretty good pit crews, but that one pays. That's a pretty substantial chunk of money at the end of the year. Pretty prestigious trophy because it says you guys were the best pit crew. You were the most valuable pit crew for that company for the entire series.
What's the lifespan of a pit crew member? Like, as far as job goes,
it's changed. And I think it varies by position, but, if you were to start this when you're 21, which I did, I'm 37 now. I'm at the tail end of my career. I think you can get into your like early 40s.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
What is it that you lose in your 40s? Just mobility, quickness?
Yeah, you just lose a step. I mean, Father Time's undefeated.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's just like anything else. You might, the thing that sucks is by the time you get to like 36, 37, you have all the experience. There's nothing that is going to come up that you really haven't seen or you can't react to. But sometimes you just lose it, you know, a little bit of step on some 22-year-old kid who's like right behind you, who can do 95% of what you can do. He might just not have the experience, but he's got all the speed. So, and it's just like any other sport. They're going to, you know, they're not committed to me forever. They're committed to me as long as I'm producing.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there any like weird things that happen sometimes? You have to like problem solve on the fly, like super, super quick, or like, is it pretty standard, take a tire out, put it on and.
No, every pit stop, there's not one pit stop I think I've done in my career that's been, that felt exactly the same as the next one. There's always something that happens, not catastrophic, but there's always these little tiny, like, nuanced things that happen that a lot of the times, if you're playing really good, you just react to, you know, and you just, after the stop's over, you're like, man, did you see that? Like, did you see what I did? You know, that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of things, like, you're just, cars coming around you, the hose might not be in the right spot, the way you throw the tire, the driver might stop long, the brake rotor might be on fire because there's rubber on it when it comes in, and that brake rotor is 1,000 degrees, you know, like, there's a lot of stuff that you see that you're just trying to, like, react to the whole time.
Can you cross thread that thing when you put it on there, the nut, or is it, like, pretty...
I've seen it happen.
I need to look it up how it looks like.
I've seen it happen. Not typically does it happen because the tolerances are so tight and we run a really fine pitch on the thread. So it's not often that it cross threads, but I've seen it. We've seen it happen.
Is there a seniority of pit crews? So if you've got two guys, you're the lug nut guy, right? Mm-hmm. But there's how many over five over the wall?
Five.
Is there like a seniority? Like there's that guy that's like the leader and then kind of trickles down from there. So you probably got some young bucks with less experience that are a little faster. And you kind of mentor those guys? Is that how that works? Or
I think every team kind of has a natural leader, you know, or someone that's going to really, that the team's going to focus around. Not necessarily like the team captain, but the guy that people look to when things go bad. Like, what's his attitude like?
Yeah.
But yeah, usually you're trying to get, there's a decent mix of pit crews that are, we have some pit crews that are in the sport that are just older in general. And they do really good because they've been doing it forever. And we have some pit crews that are younger and they just fly around the race car, but they just don't have the experience. They make a lot more mistakes.
Right.
But yeah, there's definitely, I don't want to say there's a pecking order, but there's definitely guys in the sport that people respect a lot that they're going to listen to.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you get involved in like picking new crew? Have you been involved in that? Like what makes a good pit crew?
I've had people ask me my opinions of people before we've gone to hire them or before we've made changes at different organizations, or people just want to know because this is such a tight knit community.
Yeah.
There's only so many of us.
How many are there? Do you know?
I mean, there's like 40 pit crews.
So 5 times 40. Gotcha. Not that many people.
Yeah. I'm one of 40 front tire changers on pit road.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, there's not many of us.
You're like one of 40 guys on the whole planet that does this job.
Yeah. And then we have some backup guys at the shop that are like developmental guys that are like trying to make it. They're the kids that come right out of college and they're like trying to learn the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I don't know. It's a good, I mean, you try to mentor the young kids coming up because, you know, you're only going to do it for so long. And I want to beat everybody that on the same playing level. I'm going to get any young kid comes up to me and asks me like, hey, what am I doing? I'm going to give them all the information that I got because hopefully it helps them in their career long term, but it's going to help me be more competitive because like a high water rises all ships.
Yeah.
So while you were just going through that, I was watching a little YouTube video and that shit's fast.
Yeah,
it's like when they're watching this shit in slow motion, it's NASCAR's YouTube channel. The problem is NASCAR has 1.4 million subscribers, but this video only has 3,858 views.
So we need some going more love for the pictures.
I know. Yeah. It's picture explained tire changers. And I'm watching these front tire dudes changing tires right now. And they're like kicking the feet, like using their foot to kick some of these tires away too sometimes, like on here. I don't know if that's the thing they normally do. But like the slow motion, I'm like, how the hell are you doing that fast? Like, it's crazy fast, changing a tire.
Oh, back when it was, like, right now it's one lug nut.
I can't imagine five lugs. That's crazy.
When it was five lugs, there was a much larger disparity from, like, good and not good.
For sure.
Yeah, and the good guys, like, I would classify myself as one of the good guys that did it. I mean, we're hitting five lug nuts in 6/10 of a second.
Oh.
So just over a half a second, I could knock off five lug nuts, pull the wheel, and then going back on, I could get them tight in 6/7 of a second.
You ever forget one?
Yeah. I made a career of hitting four or five. Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine.
Speed, right?
And you jump over the block and you're like, man, I missed that one lug nut.
Well, the funny thing is that this video does show one guy driving off and all of a sudden his tire's just coming off.
Oh, we had a slew of that yesterday in Vegas.
Really?
Yeah. It was bad.
Huh.
It was tough for pickers in the trenches yesterday. Yeah. That's a bad thing. Like with the five lug, you didn't have to get all five of them tight for the wheel to be tight, right? Sure, yeah. depending on what track you went to, three would have sufficed. Four is kind of what you want everywhere, but five.
Was there ever a strategy back in the day where you could only put three on because it's faster? It was.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you're required to do five?
Yes, and NASCAR was not really thrilled about that.
Yeah, I bet.
So they made some rule changes. But yeah, we only used to glue up four lug nuts because one less lug nut, it's faster.
Yeah.
And we did that. Yeah. But now with the one lug nut, it's either tight or it's not tight. And if it's not tight, it's catastrophic. The wheel falls off. Yeah. And depending on where the wheel falls off on the racetrack can either mean, you know, if it falls off on pit road, you just come back, tighten it up. You lose all your track position. It's kind of not the worst thing in the world, but it's not great. If it falls off on the racetrack, it's a 2-lap penalty. The tire changer, the jack man gets suspended for 2 weeks.
Oh, really?
A big deal.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. It's a big deal. So we probably had, penalties. I think yesterday in Vegas, we had two wheels fall off of cars on the racetrack, and we had another four cars probably that had issues on pit road that had to pull back into their pit stall to retighten wheels up.
Are you giving those guys a hard time after the fact? You're like, hey man, wheel came off.
I'm not giving them a hard time because that's bad karma. It's just one of those things. Vegas was really the first race this year of the five races we've been to where pit crews really, really mattered.
Hmm.
And it's the first time all year where the cars are set up where you can like go really fast. So it's one of those deals where you want to show to your team, to your organization that you're an asset. You're going to go down pit road. You're going to gain spots for the driver. So everyone's flying on the razor's edge, and it's the first one of the year, and everyone may be a little too jittered up, too ready to go kind of thing. A lot of mistakes were happening yesterday.
Do you get like a pretty intense adrenaline rush when they're coming in?
First, second stop of the race, just about every weekend.
Like, is that building as you know it's coming?
It's like standing in line in Vegas and they say scoring. You're like, all right, and here we go.
Your whole body's pulsing. You're like, oh man, here it comes.
Yeah, you get on the wall, heart rate starts to. It's usually the first stop and then the last stop, depending on where you're coming down pit road.
Right.
If you're the leader, second, third, fourth, you want to gain spots or maintain. And so you kind of get a little nervous knowing this is, hey, this is the last one. If we gain a spot here, this could put our driver in position to win. If we lose two spots here, we could lose the lead and not win this race, you know? And the difference between first and third and the prize pool is pretty substantial and the points and everything. So you want to win races. So like you kind of get a little nervous for that. And then the first stop every week, you know, you might not have done it since Thursday and now it's Sunday and you're kind of like, all right, here we go. This matters. Yeah.
Question.
It's a silly question. I'm just looking at you guys. It's like, obviously, are you guys communicating in your helmets, or are you like literally jamming out to like Metallica before you jump over the line?
No.
Pumped up.
Yeah. That first pit stop, he's got Slayer just
just going. It's like fucking pumped up, and then you jump over the line.
We were two custom ear molds. They're not noise canceling, but they block everything.
Yeah, it's gotta be so loud, right?
It's so loud. But then for my radios, I have one ear, which is that open mic channel that you guys can listen to, which is the driver, spotter, crew chief communication. And then in my other ear is our private communication amongst the team. And the only one who's really talking on that usually is the crew chief telling us we're coming to pit four tires. This is the adjustments I want to do. These are the air pressures I want to make. This is the situation we have, you know, the nine cars, 10 spots behind us, they're going to be coming around while you guys are out there on pit road, or, you know, the four car is going to be pitted right in front of us. We're going to be nosed in. So there's a lot of information coming in all at once.
Are you making air pressure changes in the tire, like that comes in, or is the tire that you change already set up for the new pressure?
The new tire that's going on will change air pressure on that. And we're not,
is that your responsibility?
It's not. There's another guy that's everything on the now with the way NASCAR is. Everybody's specialized in what they do.
Mm-hmm.
I only change front tires for Hendrick Motorsports. I don't do anything else. That's my sole responsibility. But we're making air pressure changes like tenths of a pound. We're not making like 1 or 2 pound air pressure adjustments.
Tenths of
a pound makes a huge difference.
Based on grip and temperature.
It's based on how the tires build as the car runs. You know, you drive down the road, you watch your tire pressures kind of creep up, you know, but it's how the tire pressure builds in the car as the car runs will dictate whether he's going to be too loose in the run or too tight in the run, or if we're trying to manipulate the car to do something for him.
Yeah. Is it pretty tight knit group? I would think.
Yeah, like you spend 40 weeks a year with the same people.
This is your family, right?
Yeah, you travel with them on the weekends. You're in the trenches with them all weekend on the good weeks and the bad weeks. So they are kind of like,
you have to get along, man.
Yeah, with the group we've had, we've been together for 4 years.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So it's tight knit groups.
So you're on the road how many weeks a year? 38?
38. So from Valentine's Day weekend until the first weekend of November.
Dang.
Every weekend. Every weekend except for Easter is our only off weekend this year.
How are you going to get out on bow hunts?
It's
we'll get there. What's your prep like? Like as far as physicality, like I would assume that it's probably, the better shape that you're in probably been beneficial, but there's probably a sweet spot there of being able to like be quick, but not too bulky. I mean, you said 55 pound tire, right?
Yeah.
And then like your diet, I would assume would have to be pretty dialed. Like, do you have a full race regime that you kind of maintain?
It's a long season. Yeah. I try to do the best, you know, at the age I am now and at the point of my career. When I was younger, I was trying to put on more muscle and trying to be faster and trying to be stronger. Now it's a matter of maintaining and feeling good all year, because 38 weeks will tear you up. Running, like what I do for tire changing, like my knees are not, they don't feel great all the time, because I run around and jump and slam them into the asphalt 60 times a weekend, 40 weekends a year, you know, so like it tears you up a little bit.
Yeah.
So you try to do as much as you can to maintain as much strength and fitness as you have throughout the year. Diet and nutrition plays a huge factor into that, because we're doing a lot of traveling. Usually you're trying to prep to be good on the weekend. Any given weekend, especially in the summer, we go to like Nashville in the middle of like June. You're going to lose 4, 5, 6 pounds that day in just hydration and water. So hydration is one of the huge things that we want to make sure we hit every week, because and you're dehydrated a little bit, like your reaction skills, like your brain function, it plummets. So like hydration is one of the main things that I try to like keep up on. Just trying not to carry excess weight. I have a weight right now that I kind of sit at, that 192 to 195, where I feel like really strong, but I don't feel slow. Mm-hmm. If I get up over that, I start to feel like a little slow and lethargic. But if I get too far under that, I don't feel strong to like go out there and do what I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
How many pit stops are there in a race?
Depends on the racetrack we go to. We go to a place like Daytona. We're going to pit the least amount of times as possible. We're going to put just enough gas in the car to get to the end, because you're not going to win you're not going to win the race on pit road in Daytona. You can definitely lose it, but you're not going to win.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend in Vegas, we did 7 stops. Next week in Homestead, when we go to Miami, we're going to do 10, 12 stops.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of that is based on what the track demands. Like Daytona is all about fuel. Tires don't really mean much. The only reason why you put tires on at Daytona is because you have to put so many seconds of fuel in. If you need to put 12 seconds of fuel in the car to fill it up, tires only take 9 seconds. You're going to put tires on just because you have that dead time. But when we go to like Miami next week, tires are going to mean everything. You're only going to run 30, 35 laps on a set of tires, because the fall off from lap 1 on a brand new set of tires to lap 30 is about a second and a half, 2 seconds.
Damn. Per lap?
Per lap. So like at the,
if it you have sounds a, like nothing, but reality, it's everything.
If you have somebody out there in 35 lap old tires and somebody else on new tires, like brand new 1 lap old tires, they go by them like they're standing still.
Wow.
So the engineers at the shop and all the men and women that figure all this stuff out, and the computer people.
Yeah, there's like a formula for all this stuff.
There's all this. They have it mapped out every week, and that strategy is constantly changing during the race, depending on when the cautions fall, what the competitors are doing, and you're trying to maximize as much time as possible and keep the freshest tires on your car. But you're also limited to how many you can put on, so you can't just bolt them on willy-nilly. You kind of got to be a little strategic about it, but you're trying to maximize lap time.
So much strategy goes into it, everything, huh?
Yeah.
Do you have like one main race strategist?
We have our crew chief who's in charge of the entire team. So like, okay. Rudy is our crew chief on the 24, and then underneath him he has, I think it's 3 engineers, 1 that comes to the track, 2 that work back in the shop, and then under that some mechanics. But then Hendrick Motorsports is an organization. We have a ton of other engineers that are working on all this stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. So when we're at the racetrack, we're not the only ones making these decisions. They have the people back at the shop in like our war room or
running
our team
analytics
center, and they're running analytics the whole time, and they're in constant communication, live communication with the pit box at the racetrack and between the shop, going over all these different scenarios on what is going to maximize the most, you know, like the best race strategy. So it's not like just a couple of, it's not like one or two people making the call. Like our crew chief's getting a ton of information from all these different input and all these different sources. And it's his job to make that decision. Yeah.
Man, it's a high pressure job.
It is. They, crew chief job's not, it's not, when you're running good, it's great.
Yeah.
But when you're not running good, all the fingers are kind of pointed in your direction. Like, why aren't you running good?
I would think the flame out on that job would be pretty frequent, because it seems like it would be, just because like there's so much pressure and you're either doing great or you're not. Just, and then just the stress of it seems like it would wear you out.
Yeah, and for 38 weeks of it,
you know? That's crazy.
And our off season is just, we restart in the off season, might take a couple weeks off, but then it's right back into it, you know, early December, trying to get ready for the next year, the changes you want to make to the car for the next year. It's kind of like going over, you know, maybe decisions we could have made differently to win races and trying to like figure out. And
So is your team fully set for the whole year, or do you make changes mid season? Like, oh, someone got traded to this other team and get like moved around, or just get fired and rehired.
People probably get injured, I would think, at times.
There's some of that, injuries, suspensions. If a wheel falls off, someone will fill in. You know, if a pit crew guy's not performing, you know, they're out there to try to get the best performance out of it. If someone's not performing, they'll move them down and move somebody else up that they think can fit that role and do a better job.
You probably have an understudy, I would think, right at the race, like in case somebody gets hurt or injured or sick or can't.
We have
a
couple backups.
Yeah, backups. Yep.
So like we have Hendrick Motorsports as four teams, but then there's also another team, the affiliate team that we work with, that we supply three pit crews to. So those are our like immediate backup guys. So if something were to happen, you know, they'll come get one of those guys to fill that for the rest of the race. And then when we come back to the shop on Monday, Tuesday, they're evaluating to see, hey, this is what we need to do.
Are you sore after the end of a race?
Depends on the race.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would bet. I would think you would be just like, ugh. Like,
that was a good thing about like, we raced yesterday and I got to stay here in Vegas last night. So I got to go to the hotel room. I got to go to the fitness center afterwards and just kind of flush some of that out.
Yeah.
But like sometimes you go to a race and like we'll get on that flight to go home. And that flight home for us is not like an American flight where it's like nonstop. We'll have to stop somewhere in Tulsa for fuel, and we're running these little regional jets so they don't go as fast. But you get on a plane and sit on the plane for 6 hours after a race, like sometimes getting off that plane, pretty stiff.
Yeah, I bet.
Achy.
How much interaction do you have with the driver?
Our driver, I mean, I've been on some good teams that the driver wants to interact with the guys. I'm sure
like they're the glory, right? They're the ones with their name and face and likeness on a t-shirt.
We're doing everything to help them win races. That's it. Yeah.
So but get under your skin. You're like, when's the Jeff Cordero pit crew t-shirt coming out?
Thanks. But we've, I've been fortunate to be with some good drivers that really appreciate what we do, you know, not just us as the pit crew, but what the mechanics do and the times we spend away from our families. So like the fact that they recognize that and they appreciate that and they tell us that means a lot. So, yeah.
I've never been to a NASCAR race, but the Indy races I've been to, we've had some like pit crew, like passes, you know, you can walk down pit lane and everything and kind of like interact a little bit. But like, you see those drivers come out and they're like, I mean, they look like they're the cover of like a Louis Vuitton ad or something, you know, they've got the glasses. I mean, perfect haircut. I'm just like, oh, these guys are like freaking superstars. They like walk on water. It seems like maybe a different vibe between that and maybe NASCAR, but I don't know.
Some of the NASCAR drivers now, they all look pretty. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not what it was like Dale Earnhardt, like in the 90s where everyone was kind of grungy and like dirty mechanic looking.
Cowboy a little bit, right?
And then up. Yeah. Everyone's still, you want to look good because like the companies that you're wearing on your fire suit, the companies you're representing, they want you to have, you know, they want you to be presentable.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Makes sense.
God, that's interesting. So fascinating.
I wish I knew more about NASCAR. I don't. I grew up, my family was drag raced the whole time, recreationally and then professionally too. So I know a lot about drag racing, but nothing about NASCAR. Yeah. Absolutely nothing.
It's like one of those things. Anytime we have a guest on the podcast that does something like yourself, that's like some realm. And it's like, I've said this before, probably to a point people are sick of me hearing it, but anytime you watch anybody do anything at like a top level, you can't help but be fascinated. It doesn't really matter what it is, you know, like anybody that does anything exceptionally well, I'm captivated by it. It's so interesting. So anytime we have a podcast guest like yourself that like lives in a different realm, I always go home from like, oh man, I I want to get into that. I want to watch that. I'm like, uh-huh. It's so interesting.
Every weekend.
Yeah.
We can turn it on. Yeah.
I'll have to. What do they top out at speeds wise?
Depends on the tracks we go to. Probably close to 200 going into the corners at like Michigan, somewhere like that. Daytona, when they run in the pack, they're pushing 195.
How wide will they run? Two cars?
Depends on where you go. Some tracks you can run 3-4 wide.
At 200 miles an hour?
Oh, yeah. You go Daytona, you can run 4 wide, and they're nose to tail, door to door, you know, all 30 cars in a pack driving around.
How is that not just carnage all the time?
Well, when it goes wrong, it is carnage. It's if someone makes a mistake, if they're running 3 wide and they're running 8 rows deep, and then one of the first 2 rows, the driver gives another driver like the wrong shove at the wrong time and gets him a little loose, and he can't gather it back up. When he spins, you're just, there's nowhere for anyone else to go because you're running nose to tail. And that's when you get one mistake can lead to a 20 car disaster.
Have you seen some pretty horrific wrecks?
Oh, I've seen some pretty horrific. I've seen some wrecks where I did not think drivers were walking out of them. Oh,
that's intense.
Yeah, there's
some scary.
The last Newman at Daytona a couple years ago in the 500, that was horrific. Ryan Preece flipped in Daytona last year like 17 times, and it was a violent. That was horrific. I've seen drivers up in a catch fence tearing the cars apart. Like, I've seen some pretty nasty wrecks. But again, it goes back to like the cars that they build now are like, they're safe.
Yeah,
they're relatively safe, right? All the safety stuff we have. You watch racing back in like the 80s, and you see them bouncing around. They got this like one tiny little piece of aluminum for a headrest. Like that would never fly nowadays. Now they're all full carbon fiber seats. They're all fitted to them. Belts are tight. You know, everything is just, the cars are designed to keep the driver safe.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's interesting. You watch it on TV and you see these horrific wrecks and you're like, oh wow, check that out. You know, but like you guys being on pit crew, these are like people that, you know, interact with every day in and day out. It's like family out there.
Yeah.
That would be really intense. That'd be hard. Every weekend would be gnarly.
Some of it is like I remember the Ryan Preece wreck last year. Like, he was down in our pit stall, and me and one of our other guys, our tire carrier Ryan, we were just cutting up before the race, just shooting the shit, kind of like whatever. God. And then like 2 hours later, he's going on a death roll over the backstretch, and you're just like, oh my God.
That's wild.
The car lands upside down, so yeah. They got to come over there and like help him get out or cut him out. And it's like, dude, I hope he's all right. Mm. Yeah.
Dang. Is Talladega Nights your favorite movie?
It's up there. I've heard it on a couple other podcasts before from some drivers and say that's more of a documentary than it is just a comical movie.
More of a documentary.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
I mean, Kevin Harvick bought that house and he lived in it for a while.
No way.
Yeah, the Talladega Nights.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. Oh, that's hilarious.
Yep.
That's so funny. Yeah, that's a classic. It's never not on TV and we don't watch it. We always have to tune in. It's just freaking hilarious. How'd you get into hunting? We've talked a lot about NASCAR, but I want to talk to you about hunting.
Probably via NASCAR.
Really?
Yeah, growing up in Connecticut, I didn't know what I had when I had it. Mm-hmm. Parents had 12 acres. We had like a swamp behind it. We had ducks, turkeys, deer. They got bears starting to show up now. And it's like, it would have been a hunting paradise for, you know, growing up. Never hunted. My dad killed a couple deer off the back porch, but that was about it. Moved down here, and one of the jobs I worked at, I was about an hour and a half drive, so like 3 guys, we all carpooled. And then I remember one summer we were driving up there, and they started talking about, you know, this hunting lease they were on, and like trail cameras, and like looking at deer pictures and which ones are they going to shoot. And I just kind of got interested. I've kind of always been like generally interested, but never like, this is something I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just being in NASCAR and the culture, like there's a huge crossover between like hunters and NASCAR fans.
Yeah.
So I want to try it. I want to get into it. And then the decision you have to make, do you want a rifle hunt or do you want to bow hunt? You know?
Right.
And for me, bow hunting just made more sense because I didn't want to have to buy a gun and then go to a gun range and pay for a gun membership and then only be able to hunt, you know, so many weeks out of the year. And not know where to go. But then if I bow hunted, I can shoot that in my backyard. I was in a development at the time, but I can shoot in my backyard because I had 20 yards. I can, you know, hunting season's middle of September all the way end of December. I can hunt with a bow throughout all of that. There was some okay public land around us. It gets kind of busy because they're not huge blocks, but I just figured it gave me more opportunity to get outside and be in the woods. I grew up, I was in Boy Scouts. I loved camping.
Gotcha.
So like, I just kind of like, I've always loved being in the woods. So I just figured it gave me a better opportunity. Killed the two does my first year. Gotcha. And I was like, I'm in, I'm hooked. And it's just like racing. It's nothing you do with a bow has to be the same as anybody else. You just figure it out what works for you.
Right.
Yeah. And that was 10 years ago. And
Is there different crews, mechanics? Like, do you guys talk hunting?
There's some people.
There's drivers that hunt?
There's some drivers that hunt. Yeah. Not as many as there used to be.
Yeah.
But there's definitely more that do. There are less that do now, but the ones that do, you know, they're pretty into it. But yeah, there's some of us crew guys that like, I've kind of become the resident guy on pit road to ask like about Western hunting. Nobody goes, right?
You're the guy.
I'm the guy when people want to go, they're like, hey, I want to go on this elk hunt. And I'm like, all right, well, you have to start applying for points or else you're never going to go. This is where I would recommend. This is what I would do, you know, kind of just, I've kind of become that resident guy. And then now that I own an archery shop, like anything archery related seems to funnel back to me, which is great.
Is it growing, you feel like?
Archery,
like just archery hunting in general, like among people that you interact with professionally in that realm, or more people becoming interested in it?
The COVID effect, like people got interested in it, and then some people have stuck with it, and some people not as much. But I think more people now are, with as much media that's coming out and like the access to information, especially the stuff that you guys have, it makes people interested. Like, hey, I never thought I'd be able to go elk hunting, North Carolina. I'm like, there's no way I can draw a tag. Where would I go? How would I do it? And that's how I stumbled upon Go Hunt and just started looking it up. And I'm like, it's really not that hard. Like all the resources here to tell me how to do it. I just actually have to do it.
Yeah.
Like finding the time of the racing season, that's the hardest part for me.
Yeah, I've always told people it's way more doable than you might think.
Yeah.
Like once you dive into it, it's really accessible in reality. I think it's interesting. Like, I mean, I'm a big Bill Murray fan, right? So Bill Murray was on the Rogan podcast. So I was just cruising through one day while I was driving, and I was like, oh, Bill Murray, I love Bill Murray. And like, I never would have thought in a billion years you would have Joe Rogan and Bill Murray talking about the Vegas shoot, archery shoot.
Yeah.
And they spent like 5 or 10 minutes talking about the finer points of archery in the Vegas shoot. And I was like, this is crazy. This is really interesting. It seems to be there's more people that are just kind of taking note and getting involved. So
definitely that whole Joe Rogan
and the
campaigns taken off on like social media definitely got a lot more people interested.
Yeah. And archery in general.
Yeah. It's just way more accessible.
Yeah. When did you get your first bow? How did that work out? Did you just go to a local shop and buy one?
I was afraid to go to a bow shop because it was just intimidated by it.
Okay.
And I get it now, owning a bow shop. Like, why?
Why?
It's just because you walk into a place that you know nothing about.
You've never done it?
Never done it. Everything's on the wall. Like, you don't know, like, what do I need this? Do I need that? Like, I don't want to spend this much. I don't, you know, everyone kind of... Everyone's got a different price point, or like there's people I think that are more when they come to the shop, they're like, I don't know anything about this. Tell me what I need to know. Mm-hmm. I'm more of the guy who likes to do a ton of research and kind of figure out. So that way when I go, I kind of have an idea of what I want. So that way I can, you know, make an educated decision. But like I went into a bow shop and I was just like, I was just too overwhelmed by like everything that was going on and some of the stuff they had, some of the stuff they didn't. And I was just like, I don't know. So I ended up going to like a local pawn shop that happened to sell bows as well. Not used bows, new bows. And he had like one little bow press and it was like, there's nobody else in there. It was way more like low key.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought a bow from him. It was a package Bowtech. I think it was like a Bowtech Assassin.
Mm-hmm.
Came with everything. I think I had a dozen arrows and a target and I was out the door for like $800. Immediately come home, slap the hell out of my arm with the string and was like, I'm Googling like, is this like, am I going to internal bleed now? Cause I mean, it was a huge red spot. Oh yeah.
They'll rise.
Oh yeah. It was, I wore a long sleeve shirt to the racetrack for like 3 weeks in the middle of the summer because I didn't want anybody to see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just kind of, ended up once I got into it, killed a couple does and was like shooting all the time. I'm like, this is something I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Traded it in, bought a new Matthews Halon at the time because that was the first year they came out with those and just kind of started diving down that road of like, all right.
Is that interaction that you had or the way that you felt about going into a pro shop or a bow shop, is that kind of helped dictate how you want to run your shop?
Yeah. I think some of it too was immediately going in there. Like they wanted me to meet them at their level, the shop that I went into.
There's a lot of shops. I feel like as you're speaking, if I'm thinking about it, there's a lot of pro shops that are like that. You walk into it, you don't feel quite welcome, you know, like you don't really know what to add, the right questions to ask. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And you don't really know. You don't want to look stupid. So
I think that's the biggest thing. Guys don't want to look stupid.
Yeah.
100%. And guys are very competitive too. So you want to know something. Like, you hate walking into something you don't know anything about. And you're like, oh, these guys are probably going to, you know, talk down on me. I don't know about a bow, or don't know what setup I'm looking for. So it is interesting in that sense. I think it's just a guy thing.
Yeah.
But I also, while you were talking, I pulled up your Instagram page and I was looking at the before pictures of your shop. And then the after pictures, like even looking at the before pictures, you can see how it's like, kind of like, I don't know. It's
80s pawn shop.
Yeah. And it's nerve wracking. Like, all those products were all over the walls everywhere. Like, you can't see what's going on. So like, why walking in, would you feel welcomed in a sense when all you see is just like shit that someone's trying to sell you in their face, but you don't know nothing about any of those products either. Where now you have a clean look, you got cool, you know, chairs to sit on. Like, it's a good aesthetic, pleasing look. It's more welcoming in a sense.
I don't care if someone comes in the shop and they want, you know, they don't know what they want. I'm not trying to force them out the door that day to buy a bow. Like, if you just want to come in and ask questions, I'll sit there and answer all the questions you got. And I think that's what working in NASCAR did help me immensely, because we go to the racetrack 40 weeks of the year. Someone's going to come up to me at least twice a weekend and ask what the tape on the tires is for. Mm-hmm. And it's the first time they've ever been to the racetrack, and it's the first time they've ever asked that question, but I've heard that question 10,000 times. So it's one of those situations where I'm like, I have to remember that this is the first time they've asked that question. So I have to
be nice about it.
And not that I'm going to be an ass about it, but be nice about it. And like, understand that they're asking the questions. They think it's a dumb question. I know it's not a dumb question, but trying to do that. So like, when people come in the shop now, that's kind of the way I take it. Like, I might answer the same question 4 or 5 times a day, but it's okay because I know it's the first time they're asking that question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
What made you want to buy a bow shop?
I didn't. I knew the shop, the one we ended up buying, which is Barefoot Archery in Charlotte, was up for sale like a year and a half before. A friend of mine was going to purchase it to kind of keep it in Charlotte. Some things didn't. I told him, I said, if you buy it, I'll help you do all the social media stuff on it. I'll make YouTube videos there. I'll come work there part time, because like, my schedule in NASCAR, I pretty much get out at noon every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I can come there in the afternoons and help. I'm competent working on bows. So I was like, I can be your extra tech, you know. Things didn't work out for him, but he called me when he was going to rescind his offer and said, hey, this makes sense. It's a great market. It's right in the middle of Charlotte. It's the only bow shop in Charlotte. You should really look into this, because he knows like what I do for a living. It only lasts so long. And then when it's over, your paycheck goes to zero. So you have to have something outside of racing, or even if it's in racing, working in the shop, you have to have not a backup plan, but a retirement plan, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I've loved archery, and I feel super fortunate that like, I love NASCAR so much and racing. I've been able to do that and make a living at it for so long. And I've not really, it's a lot of hard work, but it's not like I hate going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, if I could do something like this outside of NASCAR when I get done, that's kind of why I started the YouTube channel, was ultimately to kind of get paid to go hunt, grow a brand there for myself. And then that came up and I was like, all right, I think I can do this. Again, it wasn't something I was like, I want to go buy an archery shop. But it just made sense. Mm-hmm. The market it was in, the shop, knowing what the shop looked like and the customer service that was coming out of it and the quality of stuff that was coming out of that shop. I said, if we just do the bare minimum, we can immediately change the culture of this place.
Right.
Because the culture wasn't the greatest. And since we've reopened, it's been, people are coming in that haven't been in there in 10 years because they vowed never to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And now are like buying bows from us, buying equipment, telling all their friends to come. So,
yeah. And there are shops. I mean, the invention of social media, so much of more of it's like in your face now and you hear about it. But like, I mean, I've told the story before, but I went to Wisconsin there and toured the Matthews factory, and I got to go to like a local pro shop there that was in Sparta, and just an incredible experience. They got a full league going on. They got a bar where people are hanging out, having drinks, they're eating lunch. Like, it's a complete hang. Same thing when we went to the bow rack. We went up to Cam's event. Yep. You go to the bow rack, it's a hang. Like, there's people in there just hanging out. Like,
that's what we're trying to create at our shop. That's what we, hence the bar stools. And people are like, why do you have bar stools? I'm like, because I want people to hang out there. Yeah, I want people to be in there.
Themselves yeah. while they're there.
I think that's such a cool...
It doesn't have to be transactional.
No, I think it's such a cool thing to do. And I mean, you create like a hub, you know, for people that are like into the outdoors and into hunting and archery to like come hang out, you know, spend some money and shoot some arrows and see your, have your bow worked on. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, I love archery and you obviously do too, but I think like owning a shop would be fun. I mean, it would be a fun thing in my opinion to like be able to go to work every day, be like, oh, I'm going to go put this new string on this guy's bow and tune it. And just like have those interactions with people. I think it sounds like a great hang. It's just like a good time. So
it's fun to get people in there that want to do the full, you know, the full setup. Like they don't care what it costs. They want just the best stuff. And that's the one where it's like, all right, you're like, I can do everything. I can tune this thing the way I want to do it. I can do it. And then you have other guys that come in that are a little more price conscious that want to get into archery. They have a passion for it, but they necessarily don't want to spend, you know, $2,000-$4,000 on a setup.
Yeah.
So you're trying to give them the best experience they can, whether it's a brand new RX 9 Ultra with all the parts and pieces that's going out the door, or it's a Bear Gamekeeper that's going out the door for a 12-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. They pretty much get the same setup when they leave the shop. That arrow is going to fly straight. It's going to hit behind the pin. And as long as they execute, they're going to have a great experience. We're not just trying to rush people out the door and get things gone. And like, we've always told people like, hey, if you ever have any issues, just come back. Like we'll help you take care of it. We'll help you solve it. And as part of like the bow shop, like everything was in the back. Like whenever he'd tune a bow, he'd go to the back and do it. And you were just kind of like left out there.
Like to sit there and wait for your bow to return.
Walking around, looking on your phone. Right. And you just, there was no TV. There was no radio in there. There was nothing to kind of like keep you busy. Mm-hmm. And so we moved a press out to the front. We moved our vice out to the front. So like when I'm working on your bow, you have a question you want to ask. Yeah. Or like, I'm like, hey, when you're doing this at home and you're like, you're going to broadhead tune, like this is how you adjust your rest. Like this is the micro adjust. Do this, you know, make sure you tighten this back down. And it's just kind of that, like giving them more information about their setup is going to help them stay in archery longer because they're going to be interested and they can understand, they can troubleshoot or like maybe fix some small problems. So they don't have to drive an hour to come see us. Now, yeah. Do I want you to come in the shop? Absolutely. But if you have a great experience in the shop, your bow shoots well, and I've taught you how to do it, like work on it, like generally, you're going to come back. And that's all we're trying to do is create a clientele base of people that want to come see us.
Yeah. When we went to the bow rack, it was the same thing. And that was like probably one of the first shops I'd really seen it, but all their presses are like right out in the middle of the shop.
There's no so secret. Like, I don't need to keep any secrets from anybody.
So you're getting your cams timed or somebody's putting a new set of strings and cables on your bow. Like you're standing right there next to them and you're watching those people press the bow. You get to see how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think ultimately what that does, is it makes you as a consumer, like you have more confidence, obviously, in your bow tech. You're seeing your bow tech be, you know, qualified to work on your bow and talk you through the process. And then I think it just keeps you more engaged and more accurate. Anytime you're more accurate at archery, the more you want to stick with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because like you mentioned, the taking your bow and taking it behind a wall and tuning it, that's what initially turned me off with so many bow shops back in the day. Like that was the only bow shop in my town in Montana. So I had to go there for a while, but I was like, I started getting that same experience every single time. I never could see how it was working. I wanted to like, you know, talk to him while he's doing it. And so it turned me off so much. That's when I started just buying my own stuff.
How I did it.
I'm going to become my home bow shop because like the experience I get is so poor that I need to do something different. And it's like, that's why like the bow rack, like that's one that's like, hey, I could, if I had that experience, I would have never probably bought all the shit because I knew I trust them because they're doing it out in front. Yeah. So I can see everything going on.
You go hang out with your technician, watch him work on your bow, see your buddies, talk elk hunting.
Eat lunch while you're hanging out there where it's like, go away. Where it's like, okay, just drop your bow off and come pick it up in a week. And I'm like, you're going to tune it without me there? You can't really do that. Like I need to be part of the process. I need to drop back and shoot it. You can't tune it. And then I get it later. Like
there's a ton of shop. And this is the thing that one of my pet peeves is there's a ton of shops, especially the shop the one that we purchased, would not pay per tune. They're like, you don't need a pay per tune, you know? And it's kind of one of those things where it's like, granted, it is much more time consuming, especially when you're the only person there and you might have two or three other people in there. But still, if you're buying a bow, a brand new lift comes off the wall and we set it up, I'm running it through paper to make sure it shoots good. And then I'm going to run it through you through paper to make sure you can either replicate that bullet hole or you're making the same tear like three times in a row. Then I'll adjust to that tear. But if you come in and it's a 2-inch right tear and it's a 1-inch high tear and it's a 2-inch left tear, I'm like, okay, there's some things we need to work on, you know, and let's work on your grip. And then after you shoot this for a little bit, come back. But it's a lot of shops don't want to do it because it's time consuming. Mm-hmm. But when you get an arrow that flies straight, it's going to make you more accurate as an archer. And then it's just going to keep people in the sport longer.
Yeah.
That's one thing that was like,
do you do leagues or anything like that?
Not yet.
Not yet.
We have a 20 yard indoor range. It's 8 lanes across.
Gotcha.
Right now, the kind of that indoor stuff is kind of over. Like when we took over, it was like at the tail end of the indoor stuff, and we closed down for a couple weeks. We want to get, we have a youth program that we run on Saturday mornings right now. We want to get a JOAD program back in there that used to be in the past. It's just finding a JOAD coach right now is kind of tough. And then, because I'm not there on the weekends. And then we want to start running a, you know, a Vegas spot.
Yeah.
And then I think in the summer before the hunting season, we're going to run some kind of indoor animal paper face shoot. The Sitka store is right down the street from us, 2 miles in Charlotte, and they want to help us out with that. So, you know, we'll have some kind of month and a half long shoot where you can bring your bow hunter setup in and shoot, and then winner, top three, whatever it turns out to be, you know, maybe get some sweet Sitka gear out of
it. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's awesome. I want to talk to you about hunting a little bit more.
Okay.
So how was getting into Western big game hunting for you? Was it hard? I mean, intimidating?
It was intimidating. I've seen a lot of it on social media. It looked really cool. Figured it wasn't something I would never be able to do with the NASCAR schedule, because I could miss a practice during the week or two practices during the week, but the weekend, that Sunday race, that is a non-negotiable. You have to be there. That is literally what you were paying you to do. You cannot take one of those off. In the 11 years I've been in the Cup Series, I think I've only missed one, and it was because of injury. So it's one of those things where one or two, but it's one of those things that is like, it is non-negotiable. You are going to be here for that.
So there's no friends getting married.
I don't go to weddings. I don't go to any of that stuff. Just because it can.
Yeah.
And so trying to find a 5-day window to go out to Colorado or Montana to hunt, then to be able to get to the next race I need to get to and make sure I plan enough that if something happens, I could drive there worst case, or I have 4 flights that are after my first flight. So that way, if that flight gets canceled, I can pay $2,000 to get on the next one because it's still better than me missing the race.
Yeah.
That was the biggest hurdle to come over. And I'd seen a lot of people on YouTube, you know, going out for these 10-day hunts. They look really awesome. I don't have 10 days.
Yeah.
I have maybe 4 days, you know, of actual hunting I can do, because I fly in. That first day is kind of a wash. You might get to your hunting spot. You can hunt, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then Friday is pretty much you're not going to kill something. You're done. Unless you have somebody with you. You know, but the first couple hunts I went on, I was by myself. So like after Wednesday, I didn't travel more than like a 1/2 mile, 3/4 mile off the road, because if I did kill something, I was going to work around the clock. And I had everything scheduled out. I knew what processor I was going to drop it off at. I had already called them ahead of time to make sure I had, you know, they would ship. I knew a taxidermist I was going to drop it off at. I knew I had someone on call, like packer. Like if they were to, like, I were to drop something, they could come out and help me get it out. Like you have to plan all that stuff. So
you wanted to do it bad enough that you were coming out for like 4 and 5 days.
Yeah.
That's the
last 4 years in September, I only hunt for 4 days. I've been in bowls, and it's been,
Days do you pick?
I'm stuck with my schedule. So in September we run a Bristol night races on Saturday night. And it's in the middle, it's in the middle of the playoffs, which is the most tense time of our schedule. And I'm taking a whole week off to go hunting, but we run Bristol night race Saturday night. So usually get back from that race about 2 a.m, fly out of Charlotte somewhere between 7 and 9 in the morning, fly to wherever airport I'm going to. I always try to take direct flights so that way I don't have to worry about my bag getting lost. And then get a rental car, go to wherever I'm going to hunt. Usually get there Sunday night about time, maybe enough time to sit there and road bugle. Set up camp, hunt Monday, Tuesday, maybe pack in Monday, Tuesday, come out Wednesday, something maybe a little deeper, but then usually hunt by the road for the last 2-3 days and then drive back to the airport and then try to,
yeah. You doing it solo?
I've done my first three, I think my first three hunts were solo. And then the last 2 Septembers, I had Damon. You had him, yep. Damon Wolf.
Yeah.
He came, I was the first elk hunt he ever went on. He came and filmed for me in Montana 2 years ago. So I had somebody else. So something happened. I had an extra packer and he wasn't, I could just leave him.
Yeah.
Hey man.
And he would.
Yeah. He would in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I drug him all over the place. He didn't even think twice about
He never, he's the gal. We did the one hunt with him and the kid is just absolutely just,
always upbeat.
I'm
like,
upbeat.
Hey, you think we should go over here? And he's like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's yeah. Go. I'm like, completely all right. Completely upbeat about it.
I'm like
it.
Waiting for someone to be like, man, I don't
never
know.
Never a bad word. No. Never a no ever. Mm-hmm. Just like, yeah, let's do it. Yeah,
so he came out and then last year was the, I kind of finally bit the bullet because I've always wanted to kind of do it by myself because it's what everyone does on YouTube. That's the glorified thing.
Yep.
So last year I finally bit the bullet and hired an outfitter in Colorado because I wanted a better experience because I'd go out there. Sometimes you spend 2-3 days trying to find elk and then I get a day and a half to hunt them maybe.
Yeah.
So at least hiring the outfitter, like the ones I hired in Colorado, they were great. Like the first day we were on bulls every day and like good bulls. But because he knows where they're at, you know, he knows that where they're in
these bases. It cuts that learning curve a little bit.
It cuts it to where I don't have to worry about finding them. He's just going to, we're in them. Mm-hmm. So that was good. And we had some really good opportunities. I let an arrow go. Wasn't the right yardage. No. So I missed.
Over or under?
Under. Gotcha. I thought 35, 48 isn't 35. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but we were in elk. Close enough where every day we were within probably 85 yards of having a shot. Got blown by some cows. I blew a stalk trying to get into a better shooting position, just being bull in a china shop loud. Guide blew a stalk one day. Damon blew a stalk one day. Trying to do an interview. We start talking and just take off like 60 yards over there. We're like,
oh shoot.
Sweet.
How do you rate that adrenaline you feel coming in for a pit versus like drawing back and shooting at a bull?
Drawing back and shooting at a bull is way worse.
Really?
Yeah. Because the pit stop stuff, I've done it for so long. Yeah. Like I know what to expect and I know how to control myself in that situation to be able to execute. And I've done it so many times, like in the positions where like my arms, like running for a championship, last pit stop, you have to come off pit road first. My arms go numb like before the stop because you're like you're just adrenaline dump. You're just like, oh no. And then you go over there and you execute and you win the race off pit road, you win the race, win the championship. That's like you're like, I've proved it, I can do it.
Yeah.
I haven't shot a bull with my bow. So I haven't shot a bull, period. So it's kind of one of those like I'm still in that stage where I'm like, oh man.
Yeah.
Like I can shoot a whitetail, doe, buck. I get the yardage, put the pin. Let it fly.
We'll add you to the list of people that have missed their first elk with a bow.
I'm sure there's a pile. It's a huge list.
I'm trying to remember if we've talked to anybody that actually killed the first elk that they shot at. Almost everybody's missed one. Their first
it was 4 years before I let an arrow go.
Yeah.
Man, when I bow hunted elk when I lived in Montana, I missed my first bull too.
Yeah, I missed my first bull.
I've never killed one with a bow.
We had Craig Francis on. He missed his first.
Yeah.
I just think it's super, super more common than I would have thought.
Mm-hmm.
But
best part, I made a great shot. Like, there's the videos on YouTube and where I thought this bull was going to go was way further to my left. It would have been 19 yards. It would have been one of those. As long as the pins are on, I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. He jumped this fence. We're on private or public both sides, but he jumped the fence and the cows that had jumped kind of went to our left, our right. And the wind was blowing that way. So we knew we were on like a ticking clock. And when he stopped in this opening, the guide's standing right behind me. And I look back at him. I'm like thinking Ben's got his like range finder. He's like right over my shoulder. And he's going to hit the range. Tell me the range. And I look back and he's got his cow call in his hand and his range finder's in his back pocket. And he's wearing a rain jacket. So he doesn't want to move.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, I guess I'm on my own on this one. So I kind of guessed 35. And again, I haven't been in that opportunity, like in that situation to see like the size of a bull and kind of guess the yardage. And I shot great shot right through the trees, didn't hit anything, and just went right over the top, the elbow knuckle, and right under the belly. And I was like, all right.
Yeah, their bodies are so big, right, that they probably appear closer than they are, I would think.
Yeah, for me, especially looking at whitetails, and even whitetails in North Carolina, it's like hunting a coos deer. They're not big at all.
Right.
Yeah, so.
God, that's cool.
How many times have you gone out west, then? Elk hunting?
Elk hunting, six.
Times.
I went twice last year, and I've gone the last 4 years before that.
Yeah, last year you went late, and you had 10 full days.
14. I took the full deal.
Full time
off. We drove out there. I got to use that awesome TAC truck that I won last year.
Yeah, that's right. Did you win a TAC truck?
No.
I won the truck from TAC last year.
Yeah. Okay. You made the 111 yarder?
Yep.
Is that right? How many arrows did you shoot? Do you remember?
22 arrows, made one in. There was 221 entries last year. And then I was the one that when they do their shoot to like give it out.
Do you still have it?
The truck?
Yeah.
I put 20,000 miles on that thing. Dang. Since TAC, and I picked it up in September. So it's not even been a year, and I've been piling the miles on that
thing.
That's
sick. You won the TAC truck.
Yeah, that's right.
I hunted. I slept in the rooftop tent. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because that was the TAC. Because you guys met last year at TAC then, right? Mm-hmm. That was the TAC I didn't go to.
Yep.
So
I forgot that you'd won that. I remember seeing it.
Dude, actually,
sick little hunting truck.
It's a great truck. I mean, this is the first year too. Like the guy at Bear, when he was telling me when we picked it up, this is the first time. Like it's always kind of been like that base model truck, that mm-hmm. work truck. They stack everything on. No, this thing's an F-150 Lariat, heated, cooled seats, leather interior,
fully kitted out.
I'm like, this thing is.
That's awesome.
This is tight.
Huh. So you drove out and you had the whole hunt off.
Hunted the whole hunt because it was after the racing season.
Yeah.
And then I just. God, it's so hard. I did not realize how hard of a hunt. I thought because I had 14 days and I've been on elk in 4 days and I've had opportunities. I'm like, oh, 14. I'm going to be able to go in so many stalks and it's just an mm-hmm. opportunity thing. I'm going to be able to make it happen. Not the case. I saw a lot of great bulls, but getting to them was just impossible. Hmm. And like they look good on one hillside and then you get to that hillside and you're like, you realize that you're not going to find them. I mean, I jumped a bull that was 15 yards away from me that I didn't know was there. And I glassed that hillside all morning.
Yeah.
And I stopped. I was telling you before the podcast, I pulled my pack off, pulled my jacket off because I was sweating, crammed it in. I was 300-400 yards from where I needed to go from the bull that I had spotted and watched him kind of like settle down for the morning. Put my pack back on. Winds in my face, like I had a great hard wind. So I was like, I don't have to be quiet yet, but I should probably get into a position where I'm ready to do it. And I took like three more steps and this bull was 15 yards off to my left, just jumped up, scared the crap out of both of us. And it was like, I never saw him. I ended up glassing him up a couple of days later because he stayed in the same area, but it was like, I never would have seen him.
It's a completely different animal, isn't it? November to November.
Oh, we're talking about late season.
Late.
Yeah, okay. November. So September to November, it's like a completely different animal. They're hard to call in like a herd bull in September. They're relatively easy to find, but those interactions are plenty for the most part, as long as you can find them. And then you get to November, they're still pretty easy to find, but getting in within range is so hard.
Are you still bow hunting that time?
Yep. Yeah. Damn. Yeah. Late season archery hunt.
I had a friend come up. I did 4 days by myself and I had a friend come up and stay with me for a week and hunted with me. And I told him that morning we went to go look. I was like, "Yeah, we're gonna see some awesome bulls this morning." He goes, "Really?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I've been watching him on this hillside all morning."
Yep.
And his dad guides out in Colorado, and he's part of that outfit. And you know, so like they see a 315, 320 bull, and that's a big bull. And I'm like, "We're not gonna see anything that small. Like we're looking at like 350 plus bulls." And I'm like, "We glass them." I mean, it was only a half hour from the sun came up. We just started putting eyes on like two or three of them. And he's like, "This is ridiculous." He's like, "We have to go over there." And I was like, "I was over there 2 days ago. Even if we get over there, like you watch them, you can put your spotter on them and you see the bull. And then if you take your eyes off of them, come back to the spotter 10 minutes later, he's gone. But if you just leave the spotter and come back another 10 minutes later, he'll pop out. And what is an elk from the hoof to the tip? Like 9 feet? And they just disappear.
Yeah.
And you're like, dude, you get on that hillside, forget it. You're never going to see him.
Would you, looking back on that hunt, would you do anything different than what you did?
Yeah.
What would you do different?
I was a little too hard-headed where I wanted to spot and stalk.
Mm-hmm.
I would have sat water a lot more, a lot earlier, especially in the evenings. In the morning, they were moving pretty late. So you could do your morning hunt where you could get up, glass them, wait to see them bed down, kind of go after them like in that area in their bed. And hopefully they get up middle of the day, move a little bit as the sun hits the hillside. And then in the evenings, they were moving so late that you'd see them, but it would be half hour before it's too dark.
No time to do anything.
No time. It's good to get information for the next day.
Yeah.
But if you were to set, well, I talked to a couple guys that killed bulls like at Walmart or something that were going in to get coolers and stuff. And they're like, oh yeah, I've set water for the last 9 days, sun up to sundown. And I'm like, that sounds miserable. It's just, if I want a whitetail hunt, I'll stay in North Carolina. Right. That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to do the,
you wanted to hunt out.
I wanted to experience the Western thing, but I probably would have set water sooner. And I don't know if it would have made me more successful, but we sat some water holes and we had some bulls come in. I blew a stalk on one because my freaking GoPro camera on the top of my head had the LCD screen on the top lit up on the front. And I was standing in a wide open field when he came in, and it was a little 4-point, but we saw him, we heard him bust down from the top, and I'm like, I'm shooting this.
Yeah.
I made this mistake in Colorado. The first year I went elk hunting, I passed on a 4x in a 4-point unit to shoot this 5x that I watched walk away on day 2. And I was like, I got plenty of time now. So I was like, I don't care if there's a 380-inch bull 200 yards away. I'm shooting the thing that walks in front of me. And it was a 60-yard shot, and he was just behind a bush. And I got ready to draw back, and I was going to take one step outside of the bush to try to open up a shot. And I had made that quick, that little step, and it was kind of dusk, and I think he might have saw that glowing on it, and he just busted out of there.
Gone.
I did everything I could to stop him, including yelling stop.
Did you enjoy that hunt?
When I was doing it, no.
After the fact?
After I was like, I said, it, I don't know, day 9 or 10, I was like, I'll never do this hunt again. This sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 days later, I'm driving home and I'm like, all right, how long is it going to take me to draw this tag again? Because now I know, I know what I need to do.
Yeah.
That's exactly how I felt when those late season archery hunts. It's like, I always walk away from them. I've only killed one bull out of 3 years I've had a tag. Every time I come home, I'm like, oh, that sucked. That was awful, you know? But every time post maybe a month or something, I'm like, oh, that was so fun.
I mean, I applied for the same stuff again this year.
The weather's great. You know, it's like generally 50, 60 degrees. It's just, it's
20 at night.
Yeah. Cold at night, but really hard hunting, but fun. Like, I've really enjoyed those hunts, even though the opportunities for success are slim. Yeah.
I think in that area too, I went out there and I didn't have side by side, four wheel or anything like that. I think that would have opened up a lot more opportunities. Well, I was seeing bulls, but they were way off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I could have gotten in there, it would have been a lot less pressured. But I just couldn't, you know, some of that stuff would be like a 7-mile hike in. And I'm like, I don't know if I really particularly want. Sure, I should do it. But it's like, did I really want to do that? Day 8 of this hunt, my feet already hurt. And I'm like, kind of like demoralized. Yeah. I'm like, do I really want to hunt in there? Plus, then it's like, okay, am I going to stay in there when I get in there? Or is it just going to get in, blow this stock, and then let's bust out of here and do a 20-mile round trip kind of thing?
Yep.
It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, it's challenging. What are you doing this year? Do you got plans for this year already? You applying places? Or you kind of got some hunts in the works?
Applying places. I have a friend of mine that I've talked about going elk hunting with a bunch, and we've been in the same unit now twice, and we've kind of tagged up for like a day or two and like hung out. We've been talking this year of actually putting something together. Colorado's interesting for us because where we wanted to go hunt this year used to be an over-the-counter unit.
Yep.
So putting in for that, just being stuck in that unit. It's kind of like it kind of sucks, but it's like I'm not there for 10 days, so I'm only in that one unit. So why am I worried about not being able to move around? And then Montana, I'm at a place in Montana where it's, if I draw, I draw. And I have other units or other states that I'm stacking up points in, like Utah and some of these other states, that when I'm done with the NASCAR stuff, I can actually take that. Like, I can go on that 10-day hunt and I'm going to have enough points to draw a pretty good tag.
Are you looking forward to that? Like post NASCAR?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You probably love it, but you're probably really intrigued and excited about the opportunities that'll open up for you.
There's a lot of things I want to do that me and my wife want to do that is just not.
Your wife must be a saint.
Oh, dude, she's awesome. She's the best.
Does she travel with you?
No.
Gotcha.
No, she'll come to some races. Like, if we're running for the championship, she'll come to that race. It's just, as a wife of a picker guy coming to the racetrack, it's not like they get a bus to go sit in. It's not like they get to sit on top of the pit box because that's reserved for, like, the sponsors and the people that are actually paying to be on the race car. You're just standing out there in the asphalt and just
hot,
being hot. So, and then a lot of that, you know, some of that travel, they have, the team's not particularly traveling us unless it's like the championship week, then they'll fly your wife out there. So no, she likes to enjoy it from the weekend at the house and the AC, and she kind of gets her little girls weekend where she can go do the things she wants to do and catch up when I'm gone. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice blend, but I was doing this before we met, so she kind of knew what she was getting into.
Yeah, right. At least she knows.
Does she watch the races?
She watches them. She might not watch it from start to finish, but she keeps up on Twitter. Like our PR girl on our team is always constantly posting on Twitter, whatever's happening, pit stop cycles, whatever. And if we're running towards the front, she'll turn it on and pay attention, you know? And if she turns it on and we're 26th and we're three laps down, she's just going to keep going and doing her thing. Because believe me, I'm there and I don't want to be there when we're three laps down running 26th.
Gosh, that's going to be hard.
But
are you pretty competitive?
Yeah. That's the hardest thing about the whole hunting and the elk hunting thing. You know, what are the statistics? It's like 10%, you know? So it's like, I'm going to beat that. Because in my head, like in the NASCAR stuff, I've been super successful at everything I've done with championships, pit crew awards, won a 30 races at the highest level, done all the things. And then I come to this and I'm like, I'm going to be successful. And here I am. I'm seven hunts. One of them was a cow hunt. I had one of the Wyoming cow tags. We killed a cow on that hunt. But other than that, it's like, I'm going to be successful and I'm not. So it's like, it's kind of driving me up the wall a little bit.
Oof. Do you feel like you're figuring it out though? Like you're inching closer?
Every hunt I've been on bulls. I've been able to spot them. I've been able to get close to them. I just haven't been able to get, it's that last 100 yards. Mm-hmm. It's that last little piece that I don't have enough experience at. Mm-hmm. The e-scouting stuff, I'm still terrible at it, but I can generally pick a unit, and I don't feel like elk is particularly the hardest thing to e-scout for. Mm-hmm. I can generally put the pieces together and be like, okay, they should be in here. It's a mile off the road, whatever. And I can get there. And then in September, I'm a terrible caller, but I don't think it's like turkeys. You don't have to be great to get them to respond. You might have to be great to drag them in, but you don't have to be good to get them to make noise. I can get them to make noise and I can kind of get to where I can see them. But I haven't been able to like finish the hunt. Mm-hmm.
I feel like if I think back, like the first bull that I killed seemed, I've said this many times, it feels like every archery elk hunt, it feels impossible. It feels like it's just never going to happen. But then I can say pretty distinctly after killing the first bull, I was like, oh, I can do this. And it just seems like at this point, it's like, I'm going to kill a bull. I just feel like I'm going to kill a bull. And I'm sure it's that way with everything, whether it's like your, you know, pit crew, first time you've done it successfully. It's like, yeah, I can do that. I know how to do it. As soon as you do it once, it's just that you go into it with like a different mindset almost.
They say in racing, the hardest thing to do is win your first race. Once you win it and you realize that you can do it, you know what it takes to do it. And then you're like, oh, and then people just start rattling them off left and right. Like I can sit there in a race and kind of like feel the vibe of the race or feel the mood. And I can almost tell you like, hey, we'll be 50 to go. And I'll look at our Jackman Spencer and be like, we're going to win. He'll be like, we're running seventh. And I'm like, I know. And then not all the time does it work, but like, sometimes it's just like, you get the feeling you're like, yeah, we can do it.
It's intuition, right?
When the car comes down pit road, I know we're going to gain 2-3 spots. It's are we going to gain or are we going to maintain? No, we're going to gain. And then you do it. Yeah.
I was watching Colby Hanley. He's been doing this road to 30X thing. And like, he's been wandering around with his vlog stick and he was at Vegas and he was talking to Chris Perkins and he was like, what piece of advice would you give? I thought he gave a great piece of advice. He was like, if you're struggling, you can't shoot a 300, shoot a 300 at 10 yards and then do it at 12 yards and then 15 yards and work your way back 16 yards, 17 yards. He's like, it just, once you see yourself shooting a 300 in game, it becomes easier to accept that, like, hey, I shoot 300 games.
I did that in the off season.
Yeah.
This was like before the vlog stick thing, but that's something that like George Riles has always talked about. And I shot in my barn one day, it was like 11 yards. I shot a 330X. I was like, I'm not leaving the X ring and just started stuffing them in the center. And I was like, this is not that hard.
Yeah.
And then I go back out of 20 yards and it feels like the target's 60 yards away. And I should have slowly did it, but I did it. The one day it was raining. I was like, I only can shoot in here. It's dark out. I'm just going to do this. Mm-hmm. And like, I was just making the shots and I'm like, man, this is what Bodhi feels like. Just like the dot never left the center. The arrows just found it. Oh, dude, it was great. I just need to keep shooting them at 10 yards and just
Do you have archery goals? Do you like competitive archery? Is it something you want to more get into?
That's when we're done racing. I'll go shoot the ASA's stuff. So like I joke around with my wife all the time. I said, you know, when I'm done racing, I'm going to be traveling more than when I was racing, because I'm going to go shoot all the ASA stuff, especially in the beginning part of the year.
Yep.
And I've always joked around with her before we bought the bow shop. We'll see how it goes by the time I quit, if I have enough people working in there. But I always told her I'm going to leave August 15th and I'm not coming back till October. Yeah, I'm going to pile up. I'm just going to go drive around. I was going to build the truck to go drive around, but now that I have one, I'm going to go animal hunt here for a week or two. I might park at the airport, fly back for 2 days, come back out, go elk hunt, go mule deer hunt, go do all the things that I wanted to do that I couldn't do when I was racing. But we'll see how that goes with the archery shop.
Or just have a mobile bow shop too and just drive around.
I still have clients coming to Charlotte, but yeah.
Sounds like retirement's going to be pretty great.
It's going to be good. Yeah. And not slamming my knees into the ground.
Yeah.
60 times a week is going to feel pretty good too. Yeah. That's the thing. Everyone thinks that like the hike in the mountains and doing all that is like, oh, that's got to be terrible on your knees. I'm like, that's when I feel the best because it's just, yeah, it's the running around. Like come end of January when we haven't pit practiced in like 2 months, right before the season starts and we start pit practice again, that's when I feel the best because I haven't been trashing my body. Yeah, but by the time the end of the season is, like when we go on those September elk hunt, like I'm doing everything I can to manage swelling in one of my knees because I've had two knee surgeries, torn my meniscus 3 times, dislocated patella.
Really?
All this is in NASCAR. Yeah, I've torn ligaments in my thumb. I've torn muscles in my forearm from holding on to the pit gun. It's not easy on the body. Had a couple surgeries.
Yeah, then you try to go elk hunting afterwards. It's like
yeah, and then I'm trying to go elk hunting.
How heavy is the pit gun?
12 pounds. And I hold it with one hand. So like car comes in, I have 2 hands on it. Yeah. But as soon as I get it engaged on the hub, I'm letting go with my right hand and grabbing the wheel. And I'm pulling the trigger with my left hand with the pit gun. And that tire and wheel comes out as the car comes up. And the air gun's got 400 pounds of pressure in it. When you tighten the lug nut, it's 600 to 800 pounds of torque, foot pounds of torque on it. So it's not like it's... Right. Yeah. Oh, I can't sit there and pull the trigger with one hand like you would on like an impact gun. You know, it's got a little bit of torque.
Yeah.
This thing will snap it out of your wrist. It is. Yeah.
I'm trying to think about it right now too. Like all that torque going into it. And then you're so used to gripping things super, super hard all the time. And then you try to pick up a bow. You're like, okay.
Oh, and the pit gun hand is my bow holding hand. I'm always trying to be as loose and goosey as I can on my bow.
Total opposite thing.
They don't understand how I can, and I'm not great at archery. Don't think I'm not hyping myself up, but I can shoot just with some people. I can shoot. All right.
Yeah. You're good. Great shot.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you want a truck.
I did win a truck.
You're like one of two guys that I know that want a truck shooting a bow.
Yeah. So. I also want fitness and archery competition shooting a bow too.
There you go. So,
but it's one of those things. It's the NASCAR thing is so type A intense. You have to be on your game. You have to be aggressive to make the plays, where archery is very type B. You want to be relaxed. You want to let the shot just happen. It's like, how can you do both of those things kind of successfully, congruently? But I think it's a really good, like a yin and a yang, where I can sit out there. If I'm having a bad day pitting race cars, all I want to do is go home and put my hip quiver on and go in my yard. I'll tell my wife I'm going up there for 20, 30 minutes and I'll put on a podcast. I'll put on a Go Hunt podcast. I'll put on a Rogan podcast. Next thing I know, it's going to the next podcast. And I'm like, oh, it's been 2 hours. I should probably text her or look at my phone. She's texted me 4 times.
Yeah. That's me. Yeah. Saturday morning, Sunday morning. I'll be like, oh, I'm going to run up and shoot a few arrows. And then it's like noon.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I've been here since 8.
Half a day.
I've been here a whole day, pretty much.
I've been here a lot.
Yeah, you can lose track of time flinging arrows for sure, especially when you start working on something or if something's working. You know, it's funny. I was telling Devil this the other day. This is a conundrum because I never want to leave on a bad arrow. And your most perfect arrow, I don't want to leave either because I want that feeling
you
again.
You want to groove that feeling.
Yeah. So you release a perfect arrow and it hits dead X. It's like, oh, I have to shoot another one. So it's like this conundrum.
When do you leave?
Never. just keep flinging it until eventually I'm like, I just have to go make myself.
Know when you leave?
Huh?
No, when you finally leave?
What?
The day before the hunting season starts. just keep shooting all the way up
just
until
right
that
up
day.
To the end.
Yeah.
Then, yeah. All right, no, I do love it though. It's fun. Well, do you have any other questions for Jeff? What's the race this weekend? Where are you headed?
Homestead, Miami. Well, I don't know when this podcast drops, but it'll be...
Headed to Miami.
Yep.
And then where?
Martinsville, Virginia. And then after that,
You've probably seen most of the country then, huh?
We run at 20 different racetracks across the country.
Yeah. What's your favorite?
Darlington and Charlotte are probably some of my two favorite racetracks to go to, selfishly, because they are very pit stop heavy races. Darlington's 500 miles will do 12 pit stops. And then Charlotte's the Coke 600. It's the longest race of the year. 600 miles will do.
Long ways.
It's
how many hours is that race?
4.5, 5. Wow. It's a full day. We start at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We might not end until, 8 o'clock at night. There's 4 crown jewel races: Daytona, Southern 500, Indianapolis, and the Coke 600. Those are the crown jewels. Everyone wants to win those because they're ring races. They give out rings. I've won Daytona now twice, 2 years in a row, which is extremely hard to win. And then
tell Brady what the prize purse on that was.
This year it was $30 million.
What? $30 million.
I don't know the exact number, but it was right around that $30 million because it was the largest purse in motorsports history, North American motorsports history or something like that. And then the Coke 600 is the Ironman races. It's the longest one. You have to be in it from the driver's got to be in it for 600 miles. The pit crew's got to be in it. You know, you're going to do 10, 12 pit stops. One pit stop might not ruin your day, but a bad timely pit stop will. But if you're really good, you can stay up front. I've won that race twice. The first time I won it, we led one lap. And then I won it again the next year with a different driver. And we led all but 16 laps. So we led 380 something laps.
It sounds like when you're talking about all this stuff, so many things have to go perfect.
Yeah.
In a sense. You have a little bit of wiggle room, but everything has to go pretty much perfect. You got to be in the game. Driver has to be in the game. Everything else, all the stuff leading up to
the way the cars are now. I know we're trying to wrap up, but the way the cars are now with NASCAR, underneath the shell of the car, and with the exception of the engine, we buy all the stuff from the same manufacturers. So all the parts and pieces are the same. So essentially what NASCAR has done is they've taken a lot of the team side of it out of it, like the engineering of building different spindles and upper control arms and engineering that side of it to who can put these parts and pieces together the best, which driver is the best, because they did it to showcase the driver talent.
Yeah, and then who's the best strategic, the most strategic? Yep.
Which team can be the most strategic, and then it comes down selfishly pit crew-wise, which pit crew can go out there and perform week in and week out, and just absolutely, you don't have to be the fastest pit crew, but you have to be consistently the fastest pit crew. So that's selfishly everyone always asks, what do you like more, 5 lug or 1 lug? The 5 lug nut stuff, I was really good. And the team I was on, the 18, we absolutely stomped people every weekend. And we had one of the best teams in the sport, and will be one of the best teams. And now with the 1 lug, the team I'm on right now, we have that same attitude, that same mentality, and we can just go out there and stomp everybody. But I like the 1 lug nut stuff better, because back when it was 5 lug nut, you could have a team that all their cars are going to be successful because of the engineering, the parts and pieces they made are going to make those cars 2% better than the other cars in the field. Right. But now that all the cars are exactly the same, essentially, it's which team is going to execute.
Yeah.
So it puts way more pressure on us pit crew guys.
It's way more of a team aspect than I ever would have thought. When you to listen to you talk, there's a lot that goes into this. The driver's just one little cog in the whole thing.
Yeah, he's the big one in it. But
I mean, he's the big one, but it doesn't work without the strategy. He can't make a
360-degree revolution on that clock without the rest of us.
Yeah. Man, they must be exhausted after 4.5 hours of driving at 180 to 200 miles an hour.
Yeah. I mean, some of them wear those loop straps, and they'll be mentally spent. Yeah.
What about if they have to go to the bathroom?
Yeah, do they do?
You just go.
Just go?
I mean, depends on which one it is. And I hope your interior guy and him are tight. But if you got to go, you got to go.
Yeah, I guess. You just got to go.
A lot of it, too, is if you ever go on a run, right, unless you eat something that's bad, typically you can go on a run and you're not going to have to go to the bathroom. Yeah. It's kind of the same thing because your heart rate's up. You're in that fight or flight for however long. Your bowels are not the thing that your body's pushing a lot of blood to. But some drivers, there's been drivers in the sport that have to pee and almost pee every race in their suit, and it just is what it is.
That'd be me. I have to. I have to right now.
You eight pisses before we got on the podcast.
I'd have to. That'd be me, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. the laundry would hate me. The service.
You and your interior guy would have to be super yeah, tight. Super. His bonus check I'd better be pretty
a,
nice.
I'd yeah. have to be a big tipper, huh?
Yeah.
Well, man, we appreciate you coming. We probably ought to get you to the old airport.
Yep.
Good luck this week.
Thank you.
Hope you win a race. Hope you kill a big bull in September.
Yeah.
And then stay in touch. I'm excited for you to kill your first bull.
I'm waiting for it. I'm ready for it to happen. I think I've paid.
It's fun. I paid my dues.
Yeah, I hate saying that because everything's earned, like in racing. But at the same time, like, I've done a lot of the research. I've done a lot of the things. I put myself in the position. It's just a matter of finishing it.
So is the next Vegas race next year this time?
No, October? We'll be back in October.
So maybe we can have you on again after you've killed.
Yeah, that would be after that.
So,
yeah, we might do that. Yeah. We'll have to hear a recap of your successful of the hunt. Successful bull elk hunt.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
And you will kill. So,
where did people find you?
Social media on Instagram. Jeff Cordero _ is my personal, and then Barefoot Archery is our archery shop in Charlotte. YouTube, Jeff Cordero. And then on Facebook, we have a Facebook group for our archery shop.
If you're in Charlotte, then come down to the shop.
Come down to Where's the shop. That? Come hang out. It's in south end of Charlotte. You can look it up. It's 4410 Old Pineville Road in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. It's if you're flying in and out of Charlotte and you're looking for something to do, we're only like 5 miles from the airport.
Awesome.
Oh, so perfect.
Come hang out. We're open Tuesday through Saturday. And we'd love to have you down there. We got a TV on. Usually it's got a Go Hunt podcast or some hunting. Awesome. I have a playlist on there of just, you know, all these hunt videos. And
Right on. Huh. Very cool. Go buy a new bow barefoot. That'd be awesome.
Please.
More people into archery. We need more people.
Definitely do.
I just sent Brady over the weekend to see Post Malone rolled into an archery shop in Salt Lake and bought eight bows.
Yeah, eight of them. What?
Yeah. Just bought them for his sound crew.
They shoot them, man. I don't know what he's doing, but it was pretty great.
Just buy one in every color. Hey, pretty, I like it. Let's pretty just hilarious. Get
I thought that was pretty funny.
That was one of my favorite show my kids that. I'm like, look, Post is shooting a bow. It's awesome.
Well, if Post wants to come through Charlotte, we'll get him hooked up.
Yeah, absolutely. There
you go. We got a range. We'll close it. He can come shoot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Jeff.
So, thank you.